Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 12:28 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is Friday, and it is July 3rd. And of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought I would kick off this week with the dollar index. And I think dollar discussions are probably more relevant today than they have been at any point in the last 5 or 6 years, really. Because it does look increasingly likely that we are at a major turning point. And one of the clearest rationales for a concentration in US assets over the course of the last 5 years has been the strength of the dollar, particularly relative to the euro, but also to emerging markets, where we've seen really quite pronounced declines. One of the primary factors that people have been worried about with regard to the emerging markets over the course of the last few years has been the rise in US dollar denominated debt and the problems with servicing that debt when there have been clear uptrends for the dollar versus a number of emerging market currencies. But we're now at a point where the interest rate differential that the USA had enjoyed has been eroded. The Fed funds rate had been rising. And it is worth reminding ourselves that despite the fact that the stock market had a wobble in 2018 when Jay Powell came into the position of chairman of the Federal Reserve, he continued to raise interest rates. This is something that central banks do. They are very reluctant to determine or to diagnose a bubble or an overly zealous investment activity until after the fact. So when they're worried about the potential for inflation, and they were clearly worried about the potential for inflation after President Trump's success electorally in 2016, because prior to that they'd only raised interest rates once, immediately after the presidential election they added on an additional 200 basis points, with the federal government moving into massive deficit spending. The Federal Reserve decided that they were going to try and restrict some of the liquidity by raising interest rates, but they also simultaneously decreased the size of their balance sheet. So they were tightening on two fronts. Not only did they start raising interest rates, but from the end of 2017 onwards, they took approximately $750 billion out of circulation. Well, that contributed to considerable dollar strength. And both of those tailwinds for the dollar are over. The Federal Reserve's balance sheet has not far off doubled in the space of the last 9 months. The interest rate hikes that were put in between 2016 and 2019 are now gone. So those were the two big factors behind the continued outperformance of the dollar. The third that was really helping to support sentiment was the continued outsized economic growth that the US was able to put in. But now that's also in question. We still have very considerable outperformance by the technology sector, and the NASDAQ is still in the region of its peaks that were put in earlier on this week, but more importantly than that, it is still above the psychological 10,000 level. Now, we have a number of indices that are still in the region of these big round numbers. There is still the potential in the short term that we get some additional consolidation, but the much bigger point here is really about the dollar, because it gives us a much better perspective of what we might anticipate should do well in the coming months and years, because the strength of the dollar was also one of the factors that was sucking in money to the USA from all over the world, where investors were capable of picking up a positive yield. They were capable of picking up investment returns, the potential for capital market appreciation, currency market appreciation, and then the positive yield on top of that. Those factors were instrumental in the continued outperformance of the US markets between 2016 and quite recently. Now we're in a situation where the USA's response to the coronavirus has in many respects been subpar and in arguably mismanaged, that the lockdowns that were instituted were not especially effective or were, I think, abandoned too early. Now, we know a lot more about the coronavirus today than we did back in February. It is increasingly likely there's going to be a vaccine. And in fact, there's a race going on internationally to get a vaccine. So what we've already seen is that the team at Oxford is perhaps the one that's furthest along in delivering a solution. Moderna is in the process of recruiting 30,000 volunteers for its phase 3 trial of its solution. China has taken the approach that they are already administering a partial vaccine to their armed forces, with the expectation that it may be effective in less than half of people, and they think that that will be enough to support sentiment. That kind of rationale is not going to fly in a developed market. So the, I think, more careful approach that the USDA is taking is the right one. But what they're doing in India is the other side of the spectrum entirely. They intend to go from concept to general administering of the vaccine within 6 weeks, which basically throws any kind of trials-based approach to efficacy completely out the window. So there are very significant issues with governance that really do need to be considered, that when we start to think about what are the potential solutions, it's much more likely that despite media trumpeting about the success or otherwise of what happens in China, that it is much more likely we're going to have an enduring solution delivered by someone in the Europe or the UK or the USA first. But the other point, of course, is that we're still in an economic hiatus. I do think that when we think about the trend on biotechnology, that it is more likely than not we're going to see continued upside. The proof of concept that we've seen coming through from the coronavirus is significant. It really does help to, I think, give clear efficacy to the evolution of genetic solutions, of the speed of genetic sequencing, the ease of genetic editing, the clear potential for synthetic biology, where genetic solutions can be written like computer code and simply printed out. These are not just future innovations, but present innovations. They're available today. And the clear rationale for thinking about this is because the potential is that the permissioning process will get streamlined when it is clearly demonstrated that it is possible to create very significant innovations in a short period of time. Well, that is something that is potentially very lucrative for the biotechnology sector. But now when we think about the global economy, the US dollar no longer enjoys the yield differential, and it no longer enjoys the supply limitation argument. Now, does it still have the clear rationale for economic growth? Well, potentially there is a lot more competition now than there used to be, because Europe does appear to be getting its act together in terms of thinking about abandoning the austerity straitjacket. Now, this has been something that has really weighed on Europe for most of the decade, because, and I think there are obviously clear political reasons for why they decided to go with fiscal austerity, and it was really an imposition on the peripheral countries because of really loans that had gone bad, that had been lent out by pension systems in northern creditor nations. Rather than bailing out their respective pensions, they forced the periphery to engage in a very significant austerity program. But that has contributed to massive deflation in Europe. Now, when we go back and think about, there were clear bull and bear markets in the 90s, bear market in the early 2000s, another bull market in the mid-2000s. But subsequent to the sovereign debt crisis, where the low was in around 2012, we've had an extraordinary choppy market in the Eurozone. If they do in fact move increasingly towards the potential for mutualization of debt burdens, the issuance of pan-European, which are quasi-federal bonds, and the potential for some of the debt to be forgiven, then that is likely to contribute to economic growth. And there is the potential, therefore, that the euro will start to appreciate. Now, it's going to be a long time before Europe has got an interest rate differential that runs in its favor. But because we have low interest rates everywhere, there's not a lot of competition from other G7 countries in terms of the interest rate anywhere. You have to go right out to some of the riskier emerging markets to capture a yield, and then you have the question about those particular currencies. But there is the real potential that if the dollar is going to continue to move lower purely on a supply surplus argument, because the USA has been very clear in terms of producing about 50% of all of the monetary and fiscal stimulus in the last 3 months, and that is unlikely to change. So it may well help to support nominal prices in the USA. But from a currency-adjusted perspective, then that is not as compelling. So there is the potential here that European equities are going to start to outperform the broad Wall Street indices, but perhaps not the technology sector. And I think it is worth highlighting that when we look at the longer-term trends, we're at a point now where the 200-day moving average has crossed down and through the 200-week or the 1,000-day moving average. So then the big question now is, having got to this level, are we going to see an additional rally here, or are we going to move into a much more volatile environment? I do think that it is likely that Europe is going to begin to outperform Wall Street, but perhaps not immediately, that we are probably due some consolidation, or at least some further consolidation in the current area. But I do think that Europe is more interesting today than it has been in quite some time. Now, I did create a number of yield differential charts over the course of this week, and we can look at these not simply based upon the commonality of the trends, but on the the clear, significant difference between the valuation that is available in Wall Street relative to everywhere else. You can pick up about 125 basis points by investing in the US stock market over treasuries. But when you look at, for example, the UK, you are getting approximately 425 basis points. So there is a very significant pickup in the yield available from the stock market over the domestic bond market. Then when we look at Europe, you're picking up approximately 300 basis points, and that is more than double the yield available relative to the domestic bond market that you would get on the USA. In Australia, it's also around the 300 basis point level. In New Zealand, which has historically been a high yield market, the differential is not as wide because of the relative yield that is available from those government bonds. In Switzerland, it's also around the 3.5% level. So when we start to think about, well, what are the reasons why we might see some other markets outperforming the USA? Well, the clear potential is that international investors have the scope now to pick up a bonus in terms of currency appreciation and yield. Now, the big question is whether they are going to get growth. But certainly, the fact that the USA is printing money like stink is certainly a very significant factor in the potential for the dollar to trend lower. This is, I think, one of the factors we need to be particularly alert to. It is something that is a clear change. Now, if we go back and think about the long-term trend of the dollar index, it had a significant bottom in 2008, and there was a significant peak in 2016. But it has been ranging below 100 now for most of the last 5 years, and it is increasingly looking like it, or at least looking tired in this area. Major bull markets on Wall Street have coincided with significant bulls on the US stock market, although that was not true in the run-up to the peak in 2008. The dollar had been underperforming for most of that decade. The relative weakness of the dollar over this entire period had been one of the most significant factors in the continued appetite for gold. And there was a clear rationale that the USA was engaged in financial repression in the decade from approximately 1999 through until now. But it hasn't been as much of a headline grabbing phenomenon over the course of the last 4 years because the Federal Reserve was engaged in quantitative tightening and because they were raising interest rates and because the stock market was performing. There was less focus on financial repression. It is much more relevant today because of the response to the coronavirus, because they have a clear intention to manage yields, to ensure that the return on savings is going to be zero, and to entice speculation into the market. And they are chasing inflation with everything they've got. And they're going to keep printing money until they capture inflation. So gold prices rallied impressively all the way up from the lows around 2001. Now, I do think that there are important lessons to be learned from what we saw with gold, because perhaps it is better to look at it on a logarithmic scale chart. if we go all the way back and look at how the market started, we had this very significant pop on the upside in 1999. The price came just about all the way back down to the lows, rebounded, got back up to test that peak from 1999, and then consolidated for about 6 months, broke out, and then came back to test the upper side of the range again, and then moved into a new bull market. Now, that was the beginning. There was a very substantial pop on the upside, and that was when the UK sold its gold. It wasn't enough to really confirm to investors that we were in a new bull market environment. We have to start thinking about the long-term consequences, the way that investors think and how long it takes to convince the crowd that we are in a new significant bull market. Well, one thing I find particularly intriguing, really, is the length of time, because that pop on the upside was in 1999. We eventually had the breakout in 2002. So it was a full 2 years before we had a breakout to new recovery highs. We can then compare that to the very significant pop on the upside we had in early 2016. And if we fast forward then to May of 2019, it was a little under 3 years before that base formation was completed. We also have this rounding characteristic, and the failed downside breaks and subsequent higher reaction lows. It's eerily similar to what we had with gold on this occasion. Now, on the subsequent occasion, with this very significant pullback, we did come right down to test the upper side of the underlying range. Now, we didn't get all the way back down. It could quite easily have come back to 1400. It didn't quite do that. But we are now back in the region of the $1,800 area. Now, $1,800 was a significant area of resistance. Now, we're back at that area. It's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we get some consolidation here. Now, if we think again about the psychological perception stages, there was total disbelief back in the early 2000s. I'll never forget that when I first started working with David in late 2003, we were still part of StockCube. They had a consultancy arm. They sent me out with some of the other salespeople to talk to an institutional investor in Mayfair in London. They asked us what we thought were the most attractive opportunities. I remember, I'll never forget it, in fact, that I said, well, I thought gold looked very interesting because it had just completed a long-term base formation. And the person I was across the way from said, don't mention that in my presence. They had been so disappointed over the course of the subsequent bear market that it was just simply beyond the scope of what they were willing to tolerate to listen to someone else talk about a new bull market phenomenon when they had been disappointed so often previously. Well, gold then subsequently moved into a choppy uptrend. And there were consistency characteristics because it was having these significant ranges that lasted approximately 18 months. And then it was breaking out in Septembers of uneven years. And then when it rallies, it tends to rally in an extremely aggressive manner. Then it goes sideways for approximately 18 months and breaks out in 2007, rallies incredibly impressively, and then breaks out in September, October of 2009. And now we had three instances where that had happened. Well, that is clear acceptance of the trend. The way that I tend to think of these things, that when people see the evidence, when the secret of the market is revealed, when they really get a feel for the market, then that changes the consistency because the confidence increases. And when you start off on the trend, it's a gradual process of acceptance. And people see the big moves and they're incredibly scary because there is a tendency to think, well, golly, it's gone too far already. I can't possibly buy now. And then it pulls back violently. So the faithful will be the ones that buy the dip, that are completely invested in the new bull market hypothesis. The people who have not yet bought will look on it and say, oh my gosh, it's incredibly volatile now. I couldn't possibly buy it. This might be the top. But the longer this process of range and breakout and range and breakout persists, then the less likely it is that people will see volatility as an obstacle. They will look on it more as an opportunity. And when that occurs, you move from acceptance into more of a mania. Well, the next time we broke out was in 2009. We had a significant rally. Then it broke out again in September of 2010. And that was a clear inconsistency. It was a massive speeding up of the pace of the advance because it was the first time we'd seen a breakout from a well-defined range in an even-numbered year. Well, then we're in the mania, and the price just did not stop going, and it kept going. Relative to the kinds of accelerations that we've seen over the course of the last 18 months, the acceleration we saw in gold back in 2011 was modest by comparison. That also helped to ensure that the price did not completely collapse, but it did fall by 50%. Now we have to ask ourselves, well, where are we in terms of the psychological perception stages of the bull market? Well, the chances are that considering that we have such clear parallels today with what happened all the way back in the early 2000s, that we're still in the very early stages of this bull market. I would really consider the fact that the gold miners index, or the ETF, completed its base formation this year. So it completed it a year after gold broke out. So we have a 7-year base formation. And it's looking increasingly likely that all we're seeing today is a first step above the base. That still suggests that we're in very early territory. We have to also look at what's happening in the industry. There is no real appetite for investing in new mine supply. There is nobody willing to give those miners that even might want to borrow the money. There's nobody wants to give them the money because we just don't have the evidence yet that we're in a new secular bull market. That won't happen for longer. We need to see gold prices not only rally, but hold on to the rally for a prolonged period before creditors will have the confidence to supply significant quantities of money to develop long-term mining assets. The miners themselves are much more interested in mergers and acquisitions. But that doesn't increase the overall supply. It might make, there might be synergies that create more efficiency, and it might even streamline the mine life of the aggregate group, but it doesn't on aggregate increase supply meaningfully. Then when we contrast the performance of the larger miners with the smaller miners, well, then we can still see that the base formation has not really yet been completed. It is not yet above the peaks put in 2016, and we're not far off it. It might yet do so. but it's going to have to sustain a move above the $50 area. Then, of course, silver has long been considered to be high beta gold, and it too is still below the peaks put in 2016, and it's going to have to sustain a move above $20 to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment beyond the short term. Well, what this also suggests to us is that we are still in the early stages of the bull market, because the primary focus of investors today in investing in gold miners is to capture a yield. There has been a clear focus on investing in miners that deliver dividends and the potential for dividend growth. The discipline that has been enforced on miners with a concentration on reporting of an all-in sustaining price and the need to maximize cash flow, that's all representative of the belief that it is not worth speculating on what the price of gold will be, but rather on what the profitability of a miner can be in the worst case scenario. Now, that is emblematic of disbelief, because they're not willing to speculate on the price of gold. Because when investors are willing to speculate on the price of gold, what they in fact look at are the high cost producers, because they offer the most leverage to the gold price. And there is just very little appetite for those kinds of companies today. So we are still in the first psychological perception stage. People are interested in gold. There is no question about that. And the continued trend in ETF holdings of gold definitely confirms that investors are interested in gold, and they do want to capture an additional weighting in the precious metal. But they're focusing today on physical gold. They're not really focused on leveraged to gold. And until that happens, it will be clear that we're not yet at the acceptance stage. Well, that also tells us that we're still in the very early stages of financial repression. Relative to the extent of the money printing that took place all the way through and up until 2012, we're still in the early 2000s, and that would suggest that there are years of continued performance left in the gold bull market. Well, then when we think about gold on a purchasing power parity basis, well, it has been trading upwards now for a year and a half. It is still significantly below the peak put in 2011, but it is also interesting that following the bear market, we did not go all the way back down to the lows put in 2000 through to 2002. Rather, we saw a lengthy period of consolidation. I think it is quite likely that the evolution of the second psychological perception stage of the bull market in gold will be when we see gold trading out to new highs in purchasing power parity terms. And that will also coincide with the outperformance of silver, the outperformance of gold shares, but most particularly the smaller gold shares. Eventually, we'll get to a mania stage where the financial repression will get to such an extent that there will be a clear demand for physical assets. And we're not quite there yet. And not least because we continue to see that there is clear outperformance by the NASDAQ, by the Philadelphia Semiconductors Index, and obviously the continued evolution of the 5G network, the potential for significant additional infrastructure development, the requirement for processors and transmitters, for the Internet of Things. These are all factors that are continuing to push investment into semiconductors. The evolution of graphics cards and the fact that now all computers have both a dedicated graphics card as well as a processing chip has continued to create demand for shares like Nvidia. When we look at the continued outperformance of the FANG shares, now we can ask ourselves an additional question. Are we at the beginning of this trend where there's complete disbelief? Are we at the acceptance phase where people accept that one needs to have a position because these are the biggest companies in the world for a reason? Or are we at the third psychological perception stage where there is an acceptance that these are the only shares that one needs, that they will perform in good times and in bad times, that there is nothing that could happen that would potentially puncture their complete market dominance? Well, I think arguably we are in the third psychological perception stage. Now, that does suggest that when we look at these accelerating trends and the pace of the advance is most certainly picking up, it's particularly relevant to pay attention to some of the logarithmic scale charts, because when these lose consistency, not only does that put pressure on traders, but it also puts pressure on unleveraged investors. And the kinds of large investors that take positions in companies count as unleveraged investors. So Microsoft remains in a reasonably consistent uptrend over the course of the last 8 years. When we look at the long-term base, it completed that base with the adoption of the subscription business model in 2013-14. Apple has also been one of these companies that completed a long-term base and continues to trend higher in a consistent manner. Now, we can also start to think about what the consistency of the trend tells us, because we have ranges one above another, and each of the ranges has come back down to test the previous peak. Now, we saw that again in March of this year. It came back and tested the peak put in 2018, and then subsequently went straight up to a new high. The length of time that the share is consolidating is compressing. The pace of the advance is picking up. So we are now in the third psychological perception stage, and these third psychological perception stages often climax in acceleration, and the pace of the advance is picking up. So we are in an incredible liquidity-fueled environment. The quantity of money that central banks are producing and the coincident massive deficits that are also being run mean that we are in a period of combined monetary and fiscal stimulus, and that it is a truly global phenomenon, and interest rates have fallen everywhere, so that the discount rate has been completely obliterated. It's a nonsense to value companies based upon a discount rate, which is zero. The rise of earnings agnostic investing, which is a euphemism for ETFs, means that instead of looking at the valuations of companies, investors have looked more at the performance of companies. They then track a market cap weighted index using an ETF, but market cap is both survivorship biased and then success biased. The best performing companies occupy the largest positions in the index, and then that is the basis for a momentum move. With weight of money pouring into the index, it helps to further inflate the continued outperformance of the largest companies. That is something that we've continued to see right across the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, because it is by far the largest companies in the world continue to demonstrate relative strength, and they continue to trend higher in a reasonably consistent manner on a logarithmic scale basis, which means that there is weight of money pouring into these markets. For Amazon, really, it's going to have to sustain a move below 2,000 now to really question the consistency of the trend. It is now in the region of 3,000, so it's not beyond the bounds of possibility that we are going to see some consolidation in this area. One thing that is clear is that the pace of the advance has picked up. We also know that it is quite capable of pulling back by 50% and still being in a bull market. It did that in 2008 and 9. It hasn't done it in a while, but it did pull back from 2000 to approximately 1300 at the end of 2018. So the pullback we saw in response to the coronavirus was in fact milder than the pullback we saw in 2018, and subsequently the price has rallied really very meaningfully. We're certainly in the third psychological perception stage, when companies that don't make any money and are probably quite unlikely to make a lot of money are rallying in a spectacular fashion. Clear outperformance of Peloton, for example, the fact that it is up from approximately $20 to $60 in the space of 3.5 months is a really quite spectacular phenomenon. Again, it's a clear acceptance that earnings don't matter, that its market share is the be-all and end-all in really the only business model that matters when you've got zero interest rates and abundant liquidity. And it is reasonable to conclude that this phenomenon will probably persist as long as we have massive amounts of liquidity getting poured into the market. Of course, eventually that will end, and then we will truly move into financial repression, because the wealth effect that has been really very flattered by the continued outperformance of the stock market will become a thing of the past. That's when demand for physical assets really does start to pick up. That's exactly what we had with gold when the NASDAQ bubble burst all the way back in the early 2000s. Now, if we're correct in thinking that the dollar is susceptible to additional downside, well then, the fact that the euro has broken its downtrend and looks to be consolidating, the fact that the Indian rupee was stronger again in here today and has now pushed out to a new recovery high and appears to be unwinding its oversold condition. Mexico has been very determined to avoid a fiscal stimulus, so the Mexican peso is also starting to appreciate. When we look at the Philippine peso, it has for years been a weak currency, but that is no longer true. It's been rallying now for nearly 2 years, and it strengthened through the 50 area in here this week. Then when we look at, for example, the Taiwan dollar, which is very heavily influenced by the outlook for the global economy, it's also strengthening, and it is coming back down towards, or at least the dollar is falling back towards the lows put in over the course of the last decade. Then the Korean won, again, is a very significant globally influenced currency, and it has found near-term support. The Indonesian rupiah has also bounced from its lows and is coming back down towards the region of 14,000. Now, if this is the case, we're starting to see that emerging market currencies are rallying. Well, on the one hand, they have generally got younger populations, and younger populations are less affected by the coronavirus. So that is helping to boost their relative performance. Then we have the fact that younger populations and literally hundreds of millions of people entering the workforce has productive capacity that has historically combined to create economic potential. And that is certainly true of many of the large population Asian countries, most particularly India, where they have a population of young people in the numbers of about 600 million. So the demographic dividend is most acute and has greatest potential to come through in India. And the stock market there continues to rebound back towards the 200-day moving average. Now, obviously, we've had a really incredible pullback and a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, a series of failed upside breaks. So it's a clear type 2 top formation, and it's a completion with the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. But this is an extremely volatile market to begin with. It is historically quite liable to have these extraordinary pullbacks and then subsequently to recoup the previous decline relatively quickly. Now, India obviously has some problems with the non-bank lenders that will eventually have to be addressed. The banking sector has been much slower to rebound, and it is still trading below the 25,000 level. So, there are issues in the banking sector that are going to have to be addressed, but it's quite likely they will be addressed, and that the trend of governance in India, particularly a trend of a clear and honest attempt to find work for its hundreds of millions of young people, is well underway. And that suggests that India is going to be one of the clearest beneficiaries of trends as they evolve over time. It would be remiss to fail to point out the fact that China's markets have broken on the upside. Now, the problem with looking at China is that there is a dearth of governance, and therefore I believe that China is not an investable market, because when it comes to investments, you have to think about return of capital in addition to the return on capital. But China is a trader's market where you have the potential to get in and out quickly, then it is quite capable of rallying in a robust fashion. Now, I personally think that China, or at least something that Mrs. Tracy pointed out, just as a side note, this week, was that historically, the Chinese have always thought that wealth never survives for three generations. The first generation makes it, the second generation builds upon it, and the third generation wastes it. Well, Deng Xiaoping, with his overture that black cat, white cat doesn't matter as long as it catches mice, and the opening up was the first generation, and Jiang Zemin was the second generation who really helped to build on the wealth. Well, now we have the third generation, and then these are people who are not so much concerned about making money, but about power and about China's place in the world, about retaking its historical presence as the global superpower. This is very different from the kind of environment we had in China previously. It also means that the increasingly assertive geopolitical perspective, where you've got the nine-dash line that they're trying to basically claim most of the South China Sea, the increasing assertive or strident skirmishes that are occurring on the border with India, the new security law in Hong Kong, and the removal of the word peaceful takeover of Taiwan are all representative of this drive towards greater power and prestige for China. They are no longer willing to simply make money, but they also now want to take a hand in rule setting on their own terms. And this is a very significant international phenomenon because it represents the end of globalization. And I think that that is something that is completely underappreciated because there is obviously a clear representative way of thinking about the market as a global economy, but we're no longer in that kind of environment. Globalization is looking increasingly susceptible to a very significant mix-up, a very significant change. The rise of populism in the West, the increasing stridency of geopolitical ambitions in the East, that those two I think trends are non-compatible. It, I think, greatly enhances the scope that we are in fact at the peak in globalization, or that the peak occurred perhaps 10 years ago. Now, if that is indeed the case, well, then the potential for much more strident competition, for enforced reshoring, for greater automation, for a very clear response from the West as to what is it that we stand for, what are we in fact looking to defend, and how are we going to treat our own people? Those are all existential questions that will need robust answers if we are moving into a much more well-defined Cold War with an emerging Chinese superpower. Those are the kinds of questions that are going to have to be answered. And it also suggests that an answer for the debt question, an answer for the unfunded liabilities, the promises that have been made to pensioners, all of these factors will need to be addressed if we are going to, in fact, have a successful opposition to a rising National Socialist power. Because that is probably going to be the question of the next 2 decades. In the meantime, that is also likely to lend additional fuel to technological innovation, because there is nothing like competition to increase innovation on a needs-must basis. The clear conclusion, therefore, is that we're likely to see gold do well, we're likely to see physical assets doing well, but that technological innovation is on an inexorable trend of acceleration higher, and that each new innovation is contributing to that acceleration, so that we are likely to see very significant innovations in every area of society for at least the next decade, whether that is within the biotech sector, whether it's in autonomous vehicles, or in the energy sector. The long-term prognostication I've had now for at least the last 5 years was that hydrogen is going to be a significant fuel factor because of low natural gas prices. What we have just learned over time is that when commodity prices are rock bottom, particularly for a vital energy commodity, then people will think up of ways to use it. And that is what we have seen over the course of the last few years. Just about anything that is related to the hydrogen fuel cell market is rallying. And that is a significant development because these companies are small. This is one of the bigger ones, and it's 3 billion. When we then think about the fact that there are other companies, and they've been up 500-600% in the course of the last few years, some of them don't even have £1 billion in terms of their market cap. When we look at this sector, we're in absolutely virgin territory. And the total amount of money that has been committed to the sector is really very small. And yet, we've seen that the number of companies talking about how they are going to deploy hydrogen fuel cells has done nothing but increase. This then represents another iteration of the technology-led bull market, but most particularly how it applies to the energy sector. Oil prices are rebounding from historic lows, but they are likely to continue to range over the long term. We had a significant bull market in the energy sector up to the peak in 2008, and then we had a very significant supply response. What will be required to really demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment for commodities will be when we start to see industrial resources breaking back up above the 3,000 level on the LME Metals Index, breaking the more than 2-year downtrend, because that will be representative of a return to global demand growth and economic growth overall. It's likely to be funded by massive deficits, but we are likely to see a very significant global infrastructure development push, and not least because of the breakdown of globalization. So, if we're not going to rely on other countries to build the products that we require, then we'd have to do it at home. And if we're going to do it at home, then the infrastructure needs to be up to scratch. And that is something that's likely to contribute to the massive increase in government deficits to fund it. We're probably not quite there yet. It might yet be a story for 2021 or maybe even 2022. But the industrial resources, or the miners, have pushed back above their respective trend means. There is the scope that copper will lead on the upside, and it hasn't quite yet been able to break its downtrend, but we're not that far off it either. So it would be at least, I think, confirmatory of a bull market in gold that we also get a bull market in industrial resources. And when we start to string together the fact that the dollar is weakening, that the growth potential of the rest of the world is improving, and that a number of the emerging markets have got a demographic dividend, combined with the movement away from China or the reordering of a global trading network, then that all points towards a resumption of interest in the emerging markets and in commodities and in gold. But it comes at the price of continued broad outperformance of the US markets in constant currency terms. That doesn't mean that technology has to collapse. It could quite easily continue, and that there will be isolated pockets of continued outperformance. But we are approaching the point where Wall Street may start to underperform global markets. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.